and welcome to Unjustly Maligned, the show for people who go against the grain. We seek to rehabilitate overlooked, ignored, derided, and just plain hated contributions to pop culture. Novels, movies, music, comic books, video games, TV shows, whatever. If everyone hates it, we'll find someone who loves it and let them explain why you should too. This is episode 2, and you can find the show notes at ump.fm. I'm your host, Anthony Johnston, and my guest today is a games critic and journalist whose work has ranged from sex-positive criticism of dating sims to being editor-at-large for Gamasutra and just about everything in between, including her now infamous article declaring that gamers are dead during the endless August of Gamergate. You may also know her from her regular appearances on The Guardian's tech podcast, not to mention her outspoken pro-feminist stance on, well, everything. She is, of course, Ms. Lee Alexander. Lee, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. I want to clarify, because I've gotten pilloried for the Gamers Are Dead article, but I just want to make sure that everyone knows I didn't use the word dead ever once in the piece. That was someone else's article entirely. So I'm getting flack for things I didn't even say.
Oh, wow. I will hold my hand up and say I thought that was your phrase. I am sorry.
I said over. I said over.
Oh, games are over. Right.
Yeah, it's been memeified and mass attributed to me. I mean, you know, I guess the general sentiment is the same thing.
But we're writers. Words are important. I am very happy to make that clarification.
There's a lot of guys out there on Twitter. She said gamers are dead. And I have to say, well, that wasn't my phrasing.
Oh, yeah. No, I know. I have swum through the dregs of your at mentions occasionally. And yes, it's not a
pretty sight. You've probably spent more time in them than I have at this point.
All right. So today, you're talking about one of those strange phenomena that is... It is maligned, but it's also incredibly popular. So tell us what you've chosen and then give us some context around, you know, for those who may not be familiar with it, around its release and its reception. And then, you know, tell us why you actually love it.
Well, I've decided to talk about Twilight, the Twilight universe. I hesitate to say that I am a big fan, because I think the word fan sort of implies an unflinching love or a desire to swathe yourself in its branding, and neither of which are true for my relationship with the world of Twilight. But I really enjoy reading the books and watching the movies. And it's a complicated and embarrassing thing for a feminist critic to admit, because, you know, obviously... A lot of my work revolves around examining portrayals of relationships, examining portrayals of gender roles. You know, I write about games, and games are systems, and I like that those systems can be used to critique structural violence. I'm constantly pushing for people to examine the games they consume beyond mainstream appetites and to start, you know, hearing from underrepresented people or start, you know, protesting systemic prejudice. And then I'm like, well, I love Twilight, which is kind of it's like a weird position for me to be in. However, I'm always hearing from other feminists and always myself saying that, you know, what we don't want, you know, we don't want to censoriously destroy anything that doesn't, you know, meet our standards of equality. We simply want a vocabulary and an infrastructure to talk about the things that we enjoy that are problematic. You know, we just want to have a conversation. We want to be able to consume with self-awareness so that, you know, if we're enjoying something that is kind of messed up in that regard, then we at least have, we can mitigate that harm in the way that we talk about it or the way that we internalize it. But I don't really always feel that that's true when it comes to my liking Twilight. You know, if I'm having a cigarette break at the pub and Twilight comes up and I say that I like it, there's this sort of automatic scoff that occurs. And, you know, from guys and people who I definitely don't think have necessarily, you know, read or looked at any of it, they've just sort of consumed and internalized the idea that it's garbage. And I guess the contrarian in me really wants to confront that. I love garbage things that are popular. You know, when something terrible is hugely popular, nothing lights my fire like that. I was reading about Twilight before I ever broke down and read any Twilight, because obviously I know it's not great literature and the prose is not going to be anything to dial home about. But for some reason, I was fascinated by reading the critical response, the highbrow think pieces, you know, sort of condescending to this particular work, or the bafflement and the derision about, you know, who likes this ridiculous vampire romance. And I read about the production of the films. I read, you know, I read everything I could get my hands on, from analysis to backlash. And eventually I was like, you know, why don't I just read it? I was sick in bed one day. And I was like, what can I do that is going to pass the time? And I decided that I was going to download one of the movies. I think I downloaded the second movie. And by the end, I was really, really oddly riveted. And I think at that point I was like, let's do this. I'm going to go buy all the books and I'm going to watch all the movies. And I'm going to see if I can figure out why this terrible, ridiculous, laughable thing is so popular. And by the end of my journey through the Twilight universe, I still found it terrible, ridiculous, and laughable, but I also deeply fell in love with it and was interested in it. And I'm not really ashamed to say I'm a big Twilight fan.
See, there you've just gone from saying, oh, you wouldn't call yourself a big fan, to now saying, you know, I am a big fan.
Right. Clearly, I seem to have some internal conflict about it. Because, you know, everyone likes things that they know are not good. You know,
I totally understand where you're coming from in that respect. I mean, I'm a huge fan of the Fast and Furious movies, for example.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I love them. And they are, you know, by any measure, they are not great works of art. But there's something about them that I like their energy. There's, you know, I like the wisecracking, the knowing winks. There's something about them that I like. But most people, again, they're very enormously popular, but most people would look at them and go, well, those are trash.
Right. And you have to sort of, especially for me, who's a critic for a living and a writer as well, like, we're supposed to sort of feel embarrassed when we have mainstream tastes.
Well, it's where the term guilty pleasure comes from, isn't it?
Exactly. And I have a friend called Stee, and his main philosophy in life is, why should any pleasure be guilty? If you like something, just like it. Why do you have to apologize to people for it?
I absolutely agree. Is that Stee Curran?
Yes.
Right, who has an unabashed love of cheesy pop music, for example, which is, I'm sure...
Oh, yeah, he loves Taylor Swift with a fervency and a passion and a degree of honest, earnest devotion that I don't see from many people about anything. And, you know, at first, you know, when you participate in Steve's sort of karaoke social circles, you participate, you know, perhaps grudgingly or a bit ironically, even though, you know, he despises irony and he would kick you out if he detected a whiff of irony from you. But eventually you can't resist being carried along on the tide of his absolutely truthful enthusiasm for that music. And I personally have sort of learned a lot from that. And that sort of taught me to sort of turn about at a lot of my own preferences and go, why do I need to feel bad about this? But that may be why I'm constantly struggling to analyze and to rationalize my interest in Twilight. I have to have, like, you know, pithy analysis to offer from all of these hours that I have spent chewing that bubblegum. You know, like, I can't seem to let myself just go, yeah, I like a stupid, awful, destructive, you know, piece of garbage media. I have to now do all my theories about why I think it's worthwhile and what I think it expresses about the psyche of women in middle America and all this ridiculous, pretentious. Well, I mean it. I guess the word pretentious is misleading because it means that you're pretending. But yeah, I'm trying to come up with as many Twilight critical theories as I can.
It is interesting to come at it from a sort of, yeah, a response to criticism kind of way. I mean, I think, speaking from a personal point of view, I think that becomes easier as you get older. You're younger than me, and I think, you know, I maybe was around the same age as you when I kind of got over that hump. Yeah,
yeah.
And sort of you thought, do you know what, I actually don't care what other people think about. I mean, I've always liked things that are uncool. It's one of the reasons that I came up with the idea for this show, is that I like lots of things that everybody else hates or thinks are terribly uncool. I always have. But I think it becomes easier to, you know, there's still that conflict, because obviously everybody wants to be loved, accepted, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that does become easier as you get older and just become more comfortable in your own skin.
Yeah.
And realize, you know, that lovely quote, you know, people would worry a lot less what people think of them if they realized how seldom they do.
Exactly.
And I think that's absolutely true. And you only make that realization as you get older, I think. So we'll come back to middle America and middle-aged women later. That is a point that I want to make.
Sure.
I confess, I don't know a lot about Twilight beyond the stuff that just kind of seeped into pop culture because it was so popular.
Exactly. Most people think they know about it. They think it's, you know, a stupid melodramatic vampire romance, and it is. But that's basically what your average person knows about it.
Right. That's all they know. Yeah. I know, you know, it's got Edward, Bella, and the other one, the werewolf dude. It's got
Jacob.
Jacob, that's it. Sparkly vampires, yada yada. You know, that's pretty much all I know. But even, I must say, even allowing for my ignorance, which obviously I hope, you know, you'll rectify, but
absolutely,
I was really surprised to hear that you like this for all the reasons that you mentioned. you know, being as you are, as a feminist critic, and, you know, I know that you are not a sort of, you know, retiring wallflower or some kind of damsel in distress. So
not at all.
I think the only way you could have surprised me more is if you told me that you were a big fan of like the Gore books or something.
Oh no. I'm not a fan of those, but
you're not.
No, but in the 90s, I used to be in America Online role-playing chat rooms where people were role-playing World of Gore, and I didn't know what it was. Yeah, but people who were into BDSM and stuff were role-playing World of Gore in AOL chat rooms, and me being like 15 years old, often played along, you know, not knowing that it was part of this bizarre, bizarre sexually repressive you know, MRA universe. One of my friends actually recently mailed me a World of Gore book as an ironic present.
Oh, wow.
So I actually do own one.
Well, just to be clear, I just want to make sure before I start getting a hateful email, I assume you, we are both well aware that consensual BDSM is not at all like
absolutely
gore.
No one is here to kink shame.
Right.
If you want to play those things in the privacy of your safe and consensual relationships, I am 100% for that.
Absolutely, me too. There is a world of difference between that and the world presented in the books of gore,
exactly,
which are not consensual and not at all, you know, sort of talking about empowerment or.
And you can even have fantasies with your partner about, you know, forceful power dynamics if it's, you know, pre-discussed and people are comfortable with that.
Which
and
is what makes it consensual.
Exactly. Exactly. But yeah, no kink shaming here at all.
Yeah, absolutely. So, okay. What is your thinking on the whole middle-aged women drooling over Edward and Robert Pattinson thing?
Well, there is a number of there's so many interesting things going on in Twilight, and the reason that I was excited to do this podcast is because I really can talk about it for ages. So, you know, you have this character who is mousy, unremarkable, you know, doesn't know how to dress sexy. She doesn't wear heels. She has no physical coordination. Mostly what Bella does is cook, you know, jacket potatoes in the oven for her father. Like, you know, couldn't be less of a sex object or couldn't be less adherent to the sort of patriarchal advertising-led standards about what a desirable damsel is supposed to look like. She's just an ordinary girl who's, you know, almost annoyingly insecure. You almost wonder why in the book, you know, people want to be, you know, she suddenly becomes very popular in her school, despite, you know, being sullen and unpleasant to be around. She, you know, suddenly everyone wants to date her and hang out with her. But isn't that kind of the fantasy? You can be totally unremarkable and yet the forces of the supernatural natural world will bend toward you as if, like, you know, warped by a laser, and you will become the utterly unremarkable center of an epic and divine battle between, you know, ancient ageless species across four, you know, grand romance novels. So the vampire, you know, chooses her, you know, because of, you know, things like destiny. You know, it all turns out to be because of destiny in the end.
There is a lot of predestination in these books, isn't there? Which is something else I wanted to talk about. But
some of it, yeah, you don't really, I mean, she, you know, respect to the author, she manages to tie it together pretty well in the end. There's a lot of narrative decisions that are made in Twilight that seem absolutely ridiculous. For example, the vampires sparkle in the sun and that's the reason they have to stay in the dark. Or, you know, for years, you know, werewolves and vampires have fought over land and been mortal enemies. Or,
to be fair, that's actually a fairly, ever since the World of Darkness, the vampire and werewolf role-playing games, that's actually now a fairly standard trope.
Yeah, I guess it's pretty common now. Yeah, but like the most absurd things that people frequently cite from Twilight is that, you know, Bella can become pregnant with a, you know, vampire baby, and her womb is as hard as a diamond. Therefore, her husband, the vampire, has to chew the baby out so that she doesn't die, and then. And her friend, the werewolf, imprints upon her newborn baby and is therefore going to be her custodian for life. And everyone makes fun of these plot conventions. But I think it's because they make fun of them because of who they're coming from and who's writing them. But if you, there's a lot of similarly absurd things in comic books that would sound completely implausible out of context, but that are put in the stories because, you know, they allow for striking imagery or because they have, you know, larger than life emotional impact. And often we call that stuff innovation. You know what I mean?
Right, right.
And I think that it's because it's some romance novelist and it's just, you know, casual tourists in the fantasy industry that would be interested in Twilight, there's derision and there's disrespect for those narrative choices.
It's a bit like the hardcore versus casual gamer parallel almost, isn't it?
Yeah, fantasy is full of really bizarre and arbitrary gatekeeping. And I think, you know, to some extent, Twilight is a victim of that. It is not any more derivative, any more, you know, unintelligent, or any more, I don't know, bizarre and surprising than some popular video games. And they're allowed to be what they are, you know?
Yeah. Talking about the joke about middle-aged women going crazy for Twilight and stuff.
Oh yeah, which I didn't even get into explaining, but
I don't know if you remember, but there was some years ago, I think it was the first San Diego Comic-Con where they had a Twilight panel.
Mm-hmm.
If I recall correctly, they had just built Hall H, which is the massive media hall, you know, where they have the huge movie announcements and stuff. And famously, the Twilight panel was the first one, because it was the first one in this huge hall, where people were literally camping out, sleeping out overnight on the street to make sure that they got into the panel the next day in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure whether this photo was taken inside Hall H or whether it was somewhere else and it just the timing coincided. But, you know, that made all the news outlets, certainly. Mm-hmm. That was a really big deal because, you know, there were police patrolling the area, making sure that everybody was safe and what have you.
Nobody mobbed the doorways.
Well, and making sure the crowd was safe, to their credit as well. And at the same time, a photo started doing the rounds on the internet. And so I'm not sure if the photo was actually taken at San Diego or if it just coincided, but a photo was taken of a Twilight panel or convention of some kind. And it was basically, it was all adult and older women.
Sure.
Holding placards, declaring their love for Edward stroke Robert, all looking very excited indeed. You know, clearly something.
Oh, yeah.
You could only see the crowd, so you couldn't see what was happening on stage, but they were all clearly very excited about it. And somebody had captioned it underneath saying, I'm paraphrasing here, but basically saying, if this was a bunch of middle-aged guys leering at a young girl, you'd call the police.
Well, that's obviously a false equivalency. You know, the power structures for men in society are quite different from those for young women. It's not quite the same thing.
it's also just not true.
Right.
You know, you get middle-aged guys leering at young actresses and singers and stuff all the damn time.
It's implicitly condoned.
And nobody raises an eyebrow about it. So, but I think that ties in again to what you were saying about the source being maligned as much as, yes, the content, because everybody knows Twilight is mostly read by women, you know, whether they're young women or old women, it's mostly women. And as we see so much these days, any media that is largely consumed by women will immediately find itself on the back foot.
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing that happen with 50 Shades of Grey now. You know, whatever other quality criticisms we can make about 50 Shades of Grey, the fantasies and the appetites of women are usually completely shamed into silence. And that's something I think that people should take into account when they are making fun of media that is not targeted at them or made by or for them. But yeah, I guess like when I thought about why Twilight resonates like that, you know, you have to think of what is happening in the story. So obviously there's a fantasy that you can be completely unremarkable and still be desirable.
Desirable to somebody who's exotic and, you know, supernatural as well.
Exactly. Yeah. You can have an adventure too, even if you have nothing to recommend you. That is a completely relatable fantasy. But the amazing thing, you know, a lot of people talk about the sort of chastity element of the Twilight plot, which is, you know, where Edward is a vampire and he's afraid of harming Bella so that they can't do anything sexual really, because he might be driven into a frenzy by the smell of her blood.
Oh, I didn't know that. I knew that there was a sort of an abstinence thing because of Stephanie Meyer, I believe, is a Mormon.
Yeah, but I don't know how much it has to do with her Mormonism. I think a lot of people, in their rush to sort of shame Twilight, were incredibly eager to prescribe a creepy religious agenda onto the author that I haven't seen any evidence that she consciously intended.
Okay.
You know, I don't believe that she was trying to preach with the books. I think that when you're a woman in high school, male sex appetites are actually very foreign and very frightening. Men tend to want things from women before women are ready to deal with that. Men's sex desire seems to appear more quickly in high school. At least it was the case for me, where I didn't necessarily feel physically safe with guys that I liked. You know, and there is a strange sort of cocktail of guilt that young women get when they are not putting out, you know, whether or not they're ready. You know, we sort of feel like we're supposed to want these things and we're supposed to do these things. And there is a lot of sexual pressure for young women. Imagine a man who just loves and treasures your sanctity so much that even when you're ready, he tells you, you have to stop. That is a real fantasy in America. You know, I think the idea of someone who will not make you uncomfortable, that will not force you, that will tell you to wait, that he will wait for his entire life until it's safe. I mean, that is not a thing that girls hear a lot. And I think that that sexual tension with Edward is a safe space where women are sort of in control of that scary male sexual presence. You know, it's giving the woman sort of the control that she's safe from this man, and that, you know, the tension is under her control. And if she doesn't put out, he's just going to love her more. You know, that is a real fantasy that I think a lot of women would like to have happen in real life sometimes. So, you know, I kind of understand why that tension or that refusal is seen as romantic and increases women's desire for Edward, the character. And at the same time, she also has her really good friend Jacob, who's the werewolf, and he's also in love with Bella. And the danger with Jacob is that, you know, if he becomes too angry, he might transform into a werewolf and injure her if she's too close. You know, when he turns out to be a werewolf, there's a lot of him trying to manage his temper when he's close to her so that he doesn't hurt her by mistake. And so in Bella's tension between Edward and Jacob, I see, you know, in the age of feminism, I think here in Twilight, we have people admitting that sometimes they're afraid of male sexuality and male anger. And I think that is an important thing for women to be able to admit in an era where we're really confusingly being, you know, we're redefining the gender roles. I think a lot of people are confused. And I think a lot of women want a fantasy world where they can admit they're scared of guys, where they can admit that they want to be rescued, and all of these things that have become unfashionable or are not permitted for women to say to one another. And I think, yeah, I think that Twilight is sort of like an anti-feminist fantasy. It's, you know, it's a world where everything is really simple and you don't have to be scared of men. And I think that's powerful.
Right. Well, I was going to say there's a similar sort of hearkening back to olden times, you know, back when everything was simpler, in a lot of male fantasy, isn't it? I don't necessarily mean male fantasy scenarios. I mean male written fantasy fiction.
Yeah.
Where the men are men and women are women, and the men all carry swords and go off and have adventures and, you know, come back and, well, I was going to say, and pillage the women while they're out there, but then come back and, you know, there's a woman waiting for them when they step back over the threshold.
Yeah.
So there is a similar sort of, oh, everything was so much better back when the gender roles were defined, fantasy going on for a lot of modern men.
Sure.
And I'm not saying that everybody who reads that fiction necessarily believes that, but
No, of course they don't.
But it's a fantasy that you perhaps would want to explore.
Yeah, the fantasy genre in general has played a role throughout history in helping us process social issues. You know, fantasy cropped up for us to start to deal with and talk about race. I think that fantasy is also a way to help us talk about and explore consciously and unconsciously our gender roles. And I don't think that we can, you know, exclude Twilight from being a part of that conversation. I think when we mock it and we shame people for questioning or for thinking about feminism or for being interested in playing out gender roles in conventional relationships, you know, that sort of worries me, I guess. And, you know, I get when people are like, what if women read this and they think that this is what real love looks like, or this is going to make people want unrealistic things from their partners. And, you know, I understand that concern. But it's funny. It's always coming from guys, and
yeah.
Guys are going to play the violent video games and say it doesn't affect their behavior. It's just for fun. Guys are going to read, you know, stupid or violent things and say it's entertainment. It doesn't influence my behavior. But when women are enjoying something, oh, suddenly it's a bad influence. It's going to change the way they think and feel. You know, I experienced this in the video game industry this year, you know, when men in general are very defensive of any criticism of the content in video games. If we say it's sexist, well, it's just a fantasy, it doesn't mean I'm sexist. Cool, fine, I got it. If it's violent, oh, it's just a fantasy, it doesn't make me violent, it doesn't mean I'm violent, it's just a fantasy. But when the Kim Kardashian game became successful, all of these game developers were tearing their hair out, being like, it teaches bad and superficial values. It promotes the agenda of Hollywood, or it promotes the agenda of microtransactions business models. It's a bad influence on the game industry. And it's like, wait, I thought we were just saying that fantasy was harmless escape and that it didn't influence people. And I think that they only trot out this argument about bad influences when it's content that doesn't target them or that they don't like.
It's one rule for them and one rule for everyone else, isn't it? Yeah.
Exactly.
I couldn't agree with you more. That argument always strikes me as bogus. And you're right, it is always men concerned that women are somehow too easily influenced by fiction.
Yes.
That they will suddenly, just fall into whatever they read, and it's ridiculous. I was thinking, actually, talking about, still on the theme of women being the main audience, I was thinking about this before the show, and one thing that occurred to me was that Twilight hit, it was early 2000s when the books were first published, I believe.
Yeah, I think so too.
And that would have been just as the Harry Potter crowd were getting too old to read Harry Potter books anymore. Like a lot of the girls who got into reading through Potter, and we know Potter was enormously popular among girls, and that,
yes,
you know, a lot of people did literally start reading as children because of Harry Potter. That's what got them into reading, which is wonderful, you know, and whatever you may think about the Harry Potter books, you've got to thank J.K. Rowling for that. She literally turned a generation onto the joy of reading. But those kids, and specifically those girls who got into Harry Potter at that time, would have been exactly the right age to then get into the Twilight books when they were being published, because they would have grown up beyond Harry Potter, would be, you know, maybe young teens or tweens themselves. And we know kids always like to read protagonists who are several years older than themselves. So, yeah, I think they would have been just the right age. And I wonder if, you know, bear with me here, I wonder if that in turn was a nascent part of the current push. Think about the timeline of the current push for diversity in media, because those same girls are now adult women.
I'm yes.
Probably looking around going, hang on, where did all the female protagonists go?
Right. Well, exactly. And I think we can't underrate the impact of the community of fandom as the internet has enabled it to be. I think that the novels and the epics that are successful now are things that lend themselves to community and are, in fact, things that cause people to go online and write fanfic about each other. You know, like, the fanfic community around Harry Potter is just like this.
It's enormous, isn't it?
This fertile country of children, of, you know, children and young people and college students playing with ideas about relationships. And most of they have taken complete liberties with what they imagine the sexualities of the characters to be. They are sort of playing dolls with J.K. Rowling's universe and using it to express things about sex and relationships. I think Twilight is the same. And now 50 Shades of Grey was a Twilight fanfic. And now that's the next phenomenon. You know, again, we should be being critical of these things. And I wish that there was a tidy arc from, you know, democratic fiction into, you know, diverse and feminist fiction. I think, you know, we're still not off to a great start if the popular media are still acting out, you know, weird patriarchal relationships. Because, like, the relationships in Twilight are not, you know, they're not healthy. You know, they might be, you know, romantic Mills and Boone type things. But for the most part, you know, Edward is controlling. He cuts the brakes out of Bella's car so that, because he doesn't want her to go see Jacob, and this is an act of love. Everyone's worried about how she's going to hurt herself, so they try to control her movements and make decisions for her. A lot of it is like textbook abuser stuff that is exacerbated in the 50 Shades of Grey imagining of these relationship dynamics, because what E.L. James really just did was take the archetype of Bella and Edward and make them into new characters that were, you know, more into BDSM.
Yeah.
That she sort of reimagined them in this context. And it is still, you know, abusive, controlling relationships if you look at it baldly and on its face. You know, so it's not exactly like, you know, these modern liberal ideas are emerging from this fiction community, but maybe it's a start. You know, at least, you know, we're seeing women in control of stories about women's sexuality. For me, I am happy for that to be the case. And while I think, again, we should have a vocabulary for criticizing and scrutinizing unhealthy relationships and unhealthy portrayals, it's not in me to shame people who enjoy these escapist fantasies, or to tell them that they're going to be influenced badly by it, or, you know, you're definitely about to go headlong into an abusive relationship because you read 50 Shades of Grey and you thought it was romantic. You know, I give people who consume things more credit than that. And maybe that makes me irresponsible as a critic, but I just can't bring myself to call something that is so obviously resonating with so many people and that is being written by women just or unfeminist or unworthy of note. I just can't bring myself to do that.
I agree that, how can I put it? Yeah, you shouldn't shame people for liking something that is obviously fantasy, and you must give people credit for being able to...
Or concern troll them either. It's the, like, you know, oh, right. You know, you can't make decisions for yourself, so this media is bad. Bad things are going to happen to you because of this media you're consuming.
Which, again, always comes from men aimed at women. It's never never the other way around.
Oh. Yeah, with 50 Shades of Grey, I've seen a lot of well-reasoned critiques from women and queer people in the kink community or in the poly community talking about what constitutes consent and healthy relationships and boundaries, because they don't, you know, people who participate in certain lifestyles are really worried about 50 Shades of Grey giving their lifestyle a bad name or introducing unhealthy boundaries into the communities in which they participate, which is a fair concern.
Yeah, I understand that, and I think that is a fair point, but I think that's not necessarily the same as just saying, you know, you shouldn't even be reading this as a fantasy.
Exactly.
One thing, touching on something you mentioned, one thing that does annoy me is how people, and again, mostly men, often malign the Twilight books because the writing is bad, the actual prose.
Oh,
and
sure.
That may be true, but I have three words for those guys. H.P. Lovecraft. Nobody can doubt my Lovecraft credentials, but I will be the first to say, boy, some of that man's prose makes my toes curl.
Exactly.
You cannot use that argument against popular fiction. There is lots of popular fiction, some of it now regarded as, you know, good art, like Lovecraft, throughout the years, that when you look at it is actually pretty bad prose, but we accept it as art and we take it into the culture because the ideas within it are worth exploring.
Oh, men are allowed to be bad at things and women are not allowed to be bad at things. It's just the standards are ridiculous.
Well, it's the whole reversal where women have to be twice as good to be seen as equal to a man.
Yeah, and even if she were a brilliant writer penning a, you know, teen vampire romance fiction, it wouldn't have helped her. I don't think it would have helped if the prose was brilliant. You know, I just don't think it would have made her work any more respected if the prose was brilliant. And honestly, I don't know if Twilight could have become the phenomenon that it had if the prose was arch and if it was sophisticated and literary and all of this. It's written like a fanfic. And there is something incredibly democratic about using prose in that way. Just like anyone who feels a little mousy or unsure of her own sexual power can see herself in Bella, anyone can see themselves in the author as well. I think for me, the accessibility of the prose was part of the fantasy. Like, wow, look what this woman can do. She's made an empire on her very simple and very normal, you know, common fantasy, you know, and I think that's kind of awesome as well. I think, you know, people probably relate to the author penning her. She had a dream about it. You know, the story is that Stephanie Meyer had a dream sort of with Edward and Bella in it. And that inspired her to sit down and start writing at home. And how many women who, you know, maybe have put their dreams by the wayside to raise families in the traditional sense, you know, dream that they can go back to their passion or go back to their dreams and write novels and have people love them. So I think that made people even more invited into the story, was the success story that the writer was someone like them, was not talking down to them, was not, you know, placing the prose at a level where they had to struggle to reach it.
Right. And it's not like modern art where you need to have studied it in order to just even understand what the hell's going on.
Exactly.
I mean, there is also an argument that simpler prose makes, frankly, for a better page turner. It may not make better high art, but...
And fine prose can still be simple. It's not so much sure. a binary between bad and simple and complicated and good. You know what I mean?
No, I was thinking of the... I don't remember the exact phrase, but I know in Stephen King's On Writing book, he, you know, very forcefully advocates for using simple words and, you know, says if you have to reach for a thesaurus, you're doing it wrong.
Exactly.
Because your audience wants to read a story. They don't want to have to be sitting there with a dictionary next to them all the time.
But I believe that Stephanie Meyer writes how, you know, your average person who's not a writer thinks. Like, you know what I mean? I think that her writing is exactly what the what the fanfiction.net community would expect, and that's the language that they speak, and that we shouldn't be derisive about it, because it's just different. It's just a different standard of quality for prose. And
it's real language. You know, let's not forget some of the beat poets and, you know, and guys like Hunter Thompson and some of the strange, you know, beatnik fiction that has been produced over the years that is colloquial and does use, well, Irvin Welsh famously writes how people talk and is lauded for it. So this is not something, as you say, it's not binary. You can't automatically say that something that is written in a colloquial sense is necessarily bad.
So, you know, as a woman who works in video games, you know, my sort of objective as a writer has been to propagate the idea that any person can be included in fantasy and escapism. Anyone should get to play. A lot of my work is done in resistance to the geek culture gatekeeping that usually surrounds fantasy and the rules about who it's for and what qualifies as legitimate. And, you know, I think that anything that protests gatekeeping around fantasy and escapism is a good thing. And there's nothing gatekeeping about Twilight. It is a fantasy story about vampires and werewolves and love that, you know, anybody can access, that doesn't require a prior literacy with, you know, it doesn't even require a prior literacy with the vocabulary of vampire lore, which is, you know, pretty accessible, I think.
That would probably be a disadvantage, in fact.
Yeah, maybe, because she just makes some things up. But yeah, I just, I really often want to encourage people to examine the automatic derision they have for mainstream fantasy done by women, because it really isn't any more or less problematic or more or less high quality than some of the stuff that, you know, passes for popular in traditional male-dominated geek culture circles.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. I will have to say, I'm not about to rush out and read the Twilight books.
No, that's another thing. I couldn't recommend them to people. I'm not going to tell you that they're good, that they're necessarily right. Good or worth your time.
But I will defend their right to exist.
Yes.
You know, to my dying breath.
Yes. Well, I'm happy to hear that, because it's like cotton candy. I, it's not nutritious, but I would never do away with it or make fun of someone for eating it.
What a lovely analogy. Okay. And on that note, Lee, where can people find you if they like what you have to say?
Well, my website is leealexander.net. I usually link to all of my projects there as a sort of central hub, although I can be a little slow about it. I post, I link everything I do, and often do too much video game related social commentary on my Twitter feed at leealexander.
And just for people who aren't going to check the show notes, that's leighalexander.
Yeah, thank you. My mother gave me a 5-letter name where three of the letters are silent. So
I'm the guy whose name people can't spell right, even when they're writing a review of the book, in which it appears in huge letters on the front.
With your name on the front. Oh, yeah. Goodness.
I know that one.
Yeah, that's tough. Even I know you, and I have to double check sometimes to make sure I'm spelling it right. It's just something a bit confusing about it.
I think it's in my case, it's also it's an English American thing. Anthony spelt without an H really isn't that unusual over here.
No,
it is unusual, but it's not that unusual. Whereas in America, it seems to be almost, you know, I may as well be spelling it with a silent Q or something. It just seems to be completely unknown. You've been listening to Unjustly Maligned, Episode 2, with Anthony Johnston and Lee Alexander. Unjustly Maligned is a 7RQ production for The Incomparable and is made in England. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. That was really a really good discussion.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. This has been super fun.
It went places I didn't expect, which is great. I genuinely was. I wasn't making it up. I genuinely was surprised when you said that you liked the Twilight books. I was like, wow, Lee, really? Because you hear so much about them being anti-feminist.
Right. I mean, that's what you hear. But, you know, why don't you ask a woman about them for real, you know?
Right. Well, and not only that, but a woman who's actually read them. That's the other thing.
And exactly, exactly. That's one of the things, like, you know, feminist criticism is so important to me, and I want to see positive portrayals in the media and all of this, but I can get frustrated by the binary rhetoric of positivity, that something is either a strong female character or it's garbage and we should never look at it. And I hate that way of doing things, because we end up wholesale shaming people for liking things that we're not even that familiar with ourselves. And I think we have to be circumspect about our vendetta. If, you know, the line that we always say is like, you can enjoy problematic things. We just want to discuss and be aware of problematic things. I want that to actually be true, instead of making people feel like they're bad feminists for enjoying something, you know?
Yeah, well, and a sudden thought has come to mind talking about that, which is that, isn't it funny how in like the world, especially in the last few years, the idea of human behavior being on a spectrum has really taken hold. Like, sexuality is on a spectrum. Gender even is on a spectrum. You know, mental awareness, mental illness problems, whatever, is a spectrum. Learning difficulties are all on a spectrum.
And so yet, social functioning is on a spectrum. And yet
our tastes are either good or you should be burned for them.
I think that's capitalism for you. I think it engenders, when you buy and enjoy something, you're not just someone who enjoys that content. You become a soldier of the brand.
Oh, the cheerleaders. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You're sort of conscripted into the service of the brands that you like. And that requires you to, using the megaphone of social media, have very extreme opinions about things. You take sides. Hang on, I'm going to pause because my friend's dog is digging in the cushions in the background. It's making annoying noise.
Oh, is that what that noise is?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Let me move her. You did. Stop it.